can get an idea here of how, if we really generate bodhicitta, these other kinds of thoughts come in our mind very easily. It's okay that people, you know, that not everybody appreciates me. It's okay that they don't all know how right I am. Yeah. Because I'm not even thinking I am right anymore. I'm not even being attached to being right. Okay? So you can see here how the seventh one was whatever you wish for in general will happen. You can see how when you really generate bodhicitta, the old things you used to wish for, you don't wish for anymore. You know, because you see how stupid they are. Yeah, I want everybody to appreciate me. Well, even if the whole world appreciates me, are we going to feel good about ourselves? No, of course not. Yeah? Even if the whole world thinks we're right, are we going to feel secure? No. Okay. So with bodhicitta, we begin to see that the things we thought we wanted before aren't very interesting, and that they're not going to really bring us the happiness we want. And so we change our attitude and we start to want something else. Okay? And what do we want? We want beings to be well and happy. We want them to be free of fear. We want them to feel safe. We want them to feel loved and appreciated. We want them to feel valued. Okay, so then, of course, everything's going to come about because other people are loved and appreciated and valued and everything. Okay? And also because of that, the force of the positive energy, the positive potential that we create through acting with this intention that cares for countless, limitless sentient beings, you know, then we're going to create so much good karma that, you know, happiness comes our way. You know, we don't have to struggle for happiness, but it just kind of knocks at our door. We struggle for happiness a lot now, don't we? Do you feel like your life is struggling to be happy? We're struggling to be happy. Yeah? And I think that's, you know, that comes very much from the self-absorbed thought. I want this, I want that. How come it's not like this? How come it's not like that? How can I make this happen? How can I make that happen? You know, when we relax a lot of that, then things are really different. Okay, eighth advantage of bodhicitta. It prevents and overcomes harm and interferences. Okay? So sometimes, you know, other people might want to harm us. And the power of love and compassion can overcome those harms and interferences. Okay? So there's the story of the Buddha. You know, I love this story. I love the story of the Buddha's life. I find it very inspiring. Okay? But, you know, one of the little episodes, he had a cousin named Devadatta. Okay? And if you think you have problems in your family, Devadatta was a real loser. Okay? He was constantly jealous of the Buddha and constantly trying to harm him out of his jealousy ever since they were little kids, you know. So Devadatta was so jealous and had so much animosity towards the Buddha that one time he sent a mad elephant to stomp on the Buddha and kill him. Okay. I mean, if Devadatta and the Buddha lived nowadays, you know, Devadatta would have, you know, done a terrorist attack instead, or, you know, dropped a bomb or something like that. But I mean, that's the scope of sending out a wild elephant in ancient India, you know. Okay. Well, the wild elephant comes charging towards the Buddha, and the Buddha's sitting there meditating on love. And the elephant, you know, is charging towards the Buddha, and then falls on his knees, so the story goes, and bows to the Buddha, because the power of the Buddha's love subdued him. Yeah? And we can see that very often, different situations in life, you know, how the power of love prevents damage to ourselves. In Asian cultures, they very often believe in spirits, spirit harm. One of the best recommendations for that is meditating on love and compassion for the spirit who's harming you. Okay? So whenever you feel somebody or some, you know, if there's some negative energy around you or you feel some other person's trying to harm you, try doing some meditation on love and compassion, wishing that person well, wishing them to be free of suffering, and see if this, you know, how that influences the situation. Because very often, you know, again, just the power of thought. Thought is so powerful. You know, because you can see, have you ever noticed, you know, that when somebody is terrified of something, very often what they're terrified happens? But, you know, because the power of their terror attracts that, you know. You go into a room and you're afraid nobody's going to like you, and sure enough, nobody likes you. Why? Because you're going in there all set for nobody to like you, so you make them not like you, because you're uptight and you're not friendly and you don't smile and, you know, so of course they're not going to like you. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. When the mind is relaxed and not afraid about whether other people like us or not, we go in the room, we act totally different, and everybody likes us. Okay? So, you know, when we have fear, you know, the fear very often makes what we're afraid of happen. Because the fear changes our actions. Okay? I'm not saying that it's, you know, all the time that our fear makes what we're afraid of happen, because lots of times we're afraid of things and they never happen. Okay? But some of these things in which, you know, the fear influences how we act, which influences what we do, which influences what we receive in return. Okay? So we can see how our own mind can bring things about. Okay, so yeah, bodhicitta prevents and overcomes harm and interferences. It's interesting because I just moved here to Boise, you know, 2.5 weeks ago. So boy, you know, Idaho has a certain reputation in the country. Yeah. Oh, you don't know what Idaho's reputation is, really. So, it's interesting because I grew up in California. California has its own separate reputation in the country, you know.
Maybe it's just you.
Oh, no. So I've kind of come here, and in the course of being here, you know, I've met so many people who are the total opposite of the stereotype that I came to Idaho with. Okay? And not only, you know, the people in the Buddhist group, but a couple of days ago I went down to Minuteman Press because we're printing the brochure for Shravasti Abbey, and I had to choose the colors of the brochure for the guy in Seattle who's doing it. So I went down, you know, just started talking to the lady who works in there. You know, this is just downtown Idaho, you know. It turns out her daughter's been to Dharamsala. And the conversation ends with her saying, "Good luck on establishing your abbey." You know? If I hadn't had a certain attitude going in there, if I had gone in like, all these people from Idaho are like that, you know. What's the guy's name in charge of the Aryan Nation?
Butler?
Richard Butler?
Didn't he die or something?
No, he moved away.
He retired.
But, yeah. Yeah, he isn't retired yet. He's rebuilding. But okay, so if I had gone into that shop with, you know, everybody is like Richard Butler, I would have never had that conversation with that lady, because I never would have started talking with her. Because, you know, we were talking, guess what colors I picked out? You know? Okay. Yeah. So, you know, gold and maroon. Okay, so... You know, team colors. And then, you know, I said to her, you know, I bet you're wondering what I am. And she said, yeah. I said, yeah, a lot of people wonder what I am. And so I said, you know, I'm a Buddhist nun and I'm a student of the Dalai Lama. And that's when it came out that her daughter had been to Dharamsala, you know. But if I had been uptight, I never would have started, you know, chatting with her, you know. But I know by now people look at me and they all wonder, like, what are you, you know. So, you know, you just take the words out of their mouth and, you know, yeah, what state are you from? You're beyond California, kid. Okay, but, you know, the attitude we go into a situation with influences how we perceive it, you know? And so I'm just meeting all these people here that, you know, like I say, they don't fit my stereotype, you know? I went to the Holocaust Remembrance on Capitol Hill, yes, at the Capitol, you know? And again, it's like, wow, you know, here are all these people now remembering the Holocaust. They don't fit the stereotype of Idaho, you know? Okay.
You haven't been to Twin Falls yet.
Twin Falls is a wonderful.
You can. I'll go to Twin Falls and give a teaching if you set it up. Okay.
Yeah.
Really. Okay, so number 9, I better move along here. We will quickly complete all the realizations of the path. Okay, so bodhicitta is the primary motivation for, you know, entering the Mahayana, okay, which is the path to Buddhahood. It's the primary thing that makes us create so much positive potential so quickly. And it enriches our wisdom because we're so motivated to meditate. So, of course, all the realizations of the path are going to flow into our mind very quickly. Okay? It only follows very naturally from there. Okay? And then the 10th benefit of bodhicitta is that we will become a source of comfort and happiness for all sentient beings. Yeah. And that's a nice thought, to think that, you know, my existence, you know, or the thoughts in my mind can be a source of comfort and happiness for other sentient beings. Okay? For example, just even knowing that the Dalai Lama, that there's a human being like the Dalai Lama, just know, even if you've never met him, you've maybe read a book or seen him on TV, does that give you some kind of sense of comfort and happiness? Yeah? Just that there's one living being who is like that, you know, it gives us, wow, I can become like that. Wow, not everybody's corrupt, you know. It's a real comfort for our own mind, and he provides such a positive example for us in our lives. Even we don't know him. Okay? So you can see how if we follow in his footsteps and cultivate the same kinds of meditations that he did in our own mind, then cause and effect function, and, you know, we can become that same kind of source of comfort and happiness for others. Hmm? Okay, so those are the 10 advantages of bodhicitta according to the usual description. There's some other ones, but I think that because time is running, maybe I better give you some time for questions and some discussion about this. Yeah.
When you were talking about the here solitary realizers and bodhisattvas, and you were distinguishing between bodhisattvas and the hearers, you described hearers as those that hear the teachings and then
mm-hmm,
teach.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't there, what is their motivation for teaching here?
Yeah, they want to share what they've learned because they value the Buddhist teachings, you know, and sometimes hearers might even teach the bodhicitta, but they don't necessarily practice it themselves, okay? But they value the Buddhist teachings and they've taken refuge and they do practice them because they can liberate themselves from all suffering. Yeah, so they have a very strong Dharma motivation. Mm-hmm.
I have your book on anger.
Uh-huh.
And I just finished several years work in human rights in different parts of the world, but particularly Brazil.
Mm.
And poverty and violence, and also I've almost lost my life a few times.
Mm.
And it's difficult to not... I don't know, without an environment that can train me or those of us who work in these ways to not carry resentment.
Mm-hmm.
And resentment about even about the ignorance of the rest of us here, including myself,
mm-hmm,
of what goes on every day,
mm-hmm,
outside of our protected sphere here.
Mm-hmm.
So I struggle with this all the time, and I struggle with it in my mind, and I know it creates a lot of blocks,
mm-hmm,
avenues into other possibilities in my life as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very difficult to, I mean, when probably a good 70% of the world lives in poverty, 30% of it, and whatever numbers mean, an abject, horrific poverty.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to put into perspective our life here, my life here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you can talk about that. You know, I'll talk about anger, and people say, "Well, read your book, read Thich Nhat Hanh's book." You know, and anger is anger can be righteous, and it can also be a strong motivating force.
Mm-hmm.
For change,
mm-hmm,
but I'm also finding it a consuming voice.
Yeah.
And I know what it took to work with people who are dying every day, and to get people to pay attention who could make a difference, and how little is really done. So I don't know how to deal with the dichotomies that I carry with me. I just finished a doctorate, and the university didn't care one whit about my human rights the dangers of human rights in the field, nor did they care about spirituality,
mm-hmm,
or one's soul,
mm-hmm,
or being able to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just moved to Boise too from location, and I'm finding there's a very strong community here, quite the opposite of the, you know, the conservative bastion of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I found my way here today through a couple of women who sent me these emails.
Hmm.
I don't know if my question is focused,
yeah,
but it's, or if it even is of interest to people here. But it's something that I struggle with.
In our book club, that's a book we are reading right now. So,
yeah. And people who have lived outside of this country.
Know what you're talking about.
It's not whether I'm liked or disliked, or whether I have enough money or a job, or whether I can fit or not fit. It's just trying to even put into perspective what I have had to live with what goes on every day here.
Hmm. Okay. I hear... It seems to me that there's a bunch of different questions in what you're asking, that you're showing the dichotomy between how so many people on our planet live outside of this country, and even in this country, compared to the middle class lifestyle that so many of us enjoy. And it seems like such, it seems unfair. It seems not right.
There seems to be no justice.
Yeah. And no justice. Yeah. And trying to put that together, how can that happen in the world? What can we do about it? And at the same time, you're saying that you find within yourself that you're angry about the situation, about the ignorance that people have, about the people who don't appreciate what they have or who perpetrate this kind of injustice on others. And on one hand, it seems like that anger can be righteous and a force for change. On the other hand, that anger can burn you inside.
And it brings me very close to, I've seen what people who perpetrate human rights abuses, I've seen what happens to street children, which is what my work was in, mm-hmm. tortured and beaten and mutilated. Mm-hmm. And I've also seen anger rise in me that would be capable of doing that to another who might have perpetrated, you know. So there's all mm-hmm. of these, and also street children also were culpable in my potential death. So, you know, the people who I was working with also, you know, it's just this incredably rich dichotomic world that I can't quite solve. Mm-hmm. And it makes life, the profundity of it, so close and yet so mm-hmm. far from where mm-hmm. I'm able to make mm-hmm. sense.
Yeah. Yeah, because in one way it's hard to make sense. Like you said, sometimes if you see what other people do, you can see an anger arise in you that could be strong enough to make you do what they do. And then it's like, I'm exactly like the person that I despise for doing what they're doing.
And some people call this post-traumatic stress or whatever, but I think that there's a lack of ability to practice or to put into perspective mm-hmm. experiences that are not common in this culture, mm-hmm. this daily event mm-hmm. here in the United mm-hmm. States. And many people do put this into perspective without the traditions of Buddhism who live and work every day. I just don't know where it is, how to do it.
How to do it,
you know, yeah. I'm grasping at the cusp, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Yeah. Buddhism can help, but it's going to take more than 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so not long ago I was teaching in Seattle, and one woman who had gone to the Gaza to act as a human shield there, and she had just come back, and she was
very much like that.
Yeah. Very much, and kind of saying, you know, I mean, dealing with the same thing, the unfairness, the injustice, her own anger, her, you know, finding that she was, yeah, that she was angry. Yeah. So it's a common experience. I felt it somewhat, I lived in India, I wasn't doing human rights work there, but, you know, when you live in India, the world is right in front of your doorstep. And coming back to this country really blew me away. It's like never, never land here, you know? I mean, people's unawareness of the rest of the world was just mind-blowing to me, really mind-blowing. The difference in the quality of life, the difference in values.
I just like to say that in a way it's harder to come back. It's easier mm-hmm. to be in the pit of the dragon, so to speak,
yeah.
the stomach of the dragon, because you're at least dealing every day with the truth.
Right.
And there's so much untruth
here. Yeah.
Because of where we live.
Yeah.
Impotence. I think I feel very impotent.
Yeah. There's something very seductive about the consumer lifestyle here, and how it's so easy that the mind gets wrapped up in it and becomes numb to all other living beings. And, you know, and caring, and then watching what the government does and feeling helpless. We talked about this, remember, because I was here right after the Gulf War, the Iraq War started. Got to keep my wars straight. Yeah, it is. Too many of them. You know, but we talk about that feeling of helplessness that can come from seeing what the government's doing and feeling, seeing the pain and misery and not being able to do anything, you know, or so it seems. I think there's a few things here, and this is where I say it's really going to take more than 5 minutes, okay? One of the things that I find very important, this is where bodhicitta really comes in, is that bodhicitta gives us a very long-term perspective on things. And I think one of the things that makes the feeling of helplessness or anger or whatever strong is because part of our mind wants things to be different from the way they are right now. And we want people's minds to change right now. And we want the world to change right now. And it's not cooperating. And when I flip, I always find it very helpful in my own practice to flip the situation and say, you know, I'm wanting everything to change quickly, to flip it and to say, do I change quickly? And when I look at my own bad habits, do I change them quickly? No. I hold on to my bad habits. I nurse them. I have incredible amount of excuses. They aren't excuses. They are valid reasonings for why my bad habits are the best way to act. You know, I can't even see my bad habits. Even when people point them out to me, I can't see them because the other people are wrong. You know? And so when I look and say, do I change quickly? No. Even the things I want to change about myself, you know, even when I can see my bad habits or negative attitudes, can I get rid of them instantaneously? No. I mean, I can see prejudice in my own mind. I think prejudice is an awful thing and should be banished from the universe. Am I free of it? No. You know, I can look in my own mind and see prejudice. Can I get rid of my own prejudice instantly? No. I have to work on it, and I have to work conscientiously, repeatedly, you know, with a kind of patience towards myself and understanding, but also with firmness, you know, not saying, oh, well, I'm, you know, biased, but who cares, that's just the way I am. No, I can't say that, you know, I've got to work with my own prejudice. But I also, you know, have to realize that there's a lot of conditioning behind certain things that it's going to take me a while to undo, and I'm going to have to put some energy into undoing it. So if I'm like that, then the other people are also like that. You know, it's going to take a while for change to come about. So when I can accept that it takes a while for change to come about, but that cause and effect function, and if you plant the seeds of change, if you water those seeds, whether it's in our own mind or whether it's in other people's minds and lives, if we do that, then change happens. You know, if we throw up our hands and say, because it's not happening immediately, I'm in despair, and we stop trying, then definitely nothing's going to change because we're not creating the cause for it. You know, but if we really believe in cause and effect, you know, we keep planting those seeds and nourishing those seeds, you know, and pointing them out to others so that others remember that they're there. You know, and then we have a sense of hope and possibility in our lives, you know, and I think that sense of hope and optimism is really, really important. Now, and His Holiness talks about it constantly, you know, about the value of just having that optimistic mind, directing our energy and efforts that way, and then whether we succeed or not, we can't control, but at least we know that we've tried, you know, and we've done our best. And the process of putting our energy into doing that is what brings joy to our life. So we're not just focused on the goal of I'm only going to be happy when everything's perfect, but what brings joy to the life is to be able to contribute to that process of making things change. You know? And we keep on doing it. And again, this is where the bodhisattva ideal is very, very important for me. Because even if I think just in a limited way, okay, you know, how much, for example, what my teachers have had to do to get me on track, okay? It's like, you know, I'll read transcripts of, or listen to my teacher's teachings. And then sometimes I'll take out notes from teachings that I've heard 25 years ago. They're telling me the same thing now that they were doing 25 years ago. You know? I'm hearing something different now than I heard 25 years ago. I'm always surprised to read those notes and say, did I hear that back then? I don't remember it. I thought I just learned that now. And to realize, no, it's there in the notes that I wrote myself, that I heard that, you know. But, you know, my mind is so obtuse, so thick that it didn't get through, that here are my teachers telling me the same thing year after year for 25, 30 years, and it's just like now I'm, you know, a little bit is beginning to sink in. Yeah, but my teachers didn't give up. Yeah, after the first year or the first 5 years or the first 10 years, they didn't say, this one's too much, you know. Believe me, they could have. They could have. They could have looked at me and said, forget this one. She is a real headache. You know.
Go back to the Catholic.
Yeah. You know, just, you know, all sentient beings, but this one is too stubborn. But they didn't do that. Yeah. I mean, in spite of everything I did, they kept going on. And they kept trying, you know. And they said the same thing year after year. It's in my notes. I can show you my notes from every year, you know. But the point is that due to their patience and their love and compassion, over time, you know, something begins to sink in, you know. But if they had just said, you know, taught her once and, you know, she didn't get it, so forget it, you know, then where would I be? I'd be thinking the way I thought then, or worse. Okay? So then I say, well, if they are willing to put that out for me, and not give up on me, you know, then they're probably not giving up on anybody else either. So if they're not giving up on others, how can I give up on others? And if somebody's extended their compassion to me and not give up on me, I've got to extend that same compassion to others and not give up on them. Hmm? And I think that give some kind of fortitude to our mind to keep going. Hmm? And in Buddhism we talk a lot about ignorance, many different kinds of ignorance, and it's always very easy to see other people's ignorance, isn't it? Yeah, it's so easy to see their ignorance. It's much more difficult to hear to see our own. And in fact, sometimes, you know, in the Buddhist teachings, when our ignorance is challenged, we argue back. Yeah? And we have all sorts of reasons, you know, that we present to argue back. when our own ignorance is challenged. For example, you know, we'll get into this when it talks in the Bodhicitta teachings about the disadvantages of self-centeredness. We argue back, but if I don't care about myself, who will? And if I don't take care of me, who will? Okay. And we argue back because we're not understanding correctly what the teachings are getting at. Okay. So when we begin to turn them, you know, instead of having the periscope looking at others' ignorance, turn it towards us and have it become a mirror and look at our own, then we can understand, you know, how deep our own ignorance is, how hard it is to realize that, and by extension, how hard it is for other people to see their own ignorance too. Yeah? And then, okay, you know, we're all alike, aren't we? We're all alike. I'm not an evil person just because I'm ignorant, you know. I'm sometimes pretty dumb, but I'm not evil, okay? And it doesn't mean I'm hopeless. So by extension, even these other people who are doing things that are tremendously ignorant, they're not evil and they're also not hopeless. And another thing I think about is the Rodney King incident. This is when it became very clear to me, because when the whole country was in an uproar about Rodney King, I realized that I could have been any of the people in the whole scenario had I been born and raised in the conditions that they had been born and raised in. You know, if I had been born in King's situation, I probably would have acted like him. If I had been born in the families of those cops who beat him, I probably would have acted like those cops. If I had been born in the situation of some of the shop owners or the situation of some of the rioters, I probably would have acted like them. So, you know, we are all products of our conditioning. And I just happen to be incredibly fortunate and not have that particular conditioning this lifetime. Who knows in the past whether, you know, how much I've had it. But I realized that I couldn't stand separate from all the different people in that whole confused scenario and say, they're all so ignorant. Because I could have been any of them, you know. And they were all different aspects of me, okay. There's a part of me, you know, that likes to race around and think I can do whatever I want and I'm not held responsible. And there's a part of me that likes to beat up on other people when they do things that I don't approve of, okay. And there's a part of me that throws temper tantrums when I think that something's, you know, not right. And there's a part of me that, you know, shuts my doors to other people. I mean, I'm like, you know, all you do is take different parts of me and project them outside and you have the Rodney King incident, you know. And I'm sure if I, you know, if I looked at the present situation with the U.S. government, as much as it pains me to admit it, there's probably a Donald Rumsfeld inside. Oh. You know? That is very painful to have to admit that, you know? But, you know, I'm sure there's a mental factor inside that if I look closely is Rumsfeld. You know? And there's another mental factor that's Bush, who likes to do this big, you know, publicity op, you know, landing on a jet in the, you know, of the big ship as it's cruising home, saying, I flew it, you know, with your phony goggles on. You know, I put my goggles on and, you know, do my own little, you know, photo ops. Yeah? So, you know, it's very interesting because, you know, people, we were just studying mind and mental factors. If you look inside, you know, different minds and mental factors, you know, instead of calling them anger or vengeance or whatever, you can call them, you know, Bin Laden and Bush and Rumsfeld and, you know, Marilyn Monroe. And, you know, I mean, we have a Marilyn Monroe mental factor inside of us, don't we? Yeah?
Would that be our feminine side?
So, you know, when we look inside, we have all of this. Yeah? And so, you know, we have to, you know, we work on our own, you know, Rumsfeld, and our, you know, our own Ashcroft. That's almost as difficult to admit as that I have a John Ashcroft. Is, oh, God. Yeah, in some ways. Well, I'm not sure which is worse, you know. But to admit that I have that inside me, you know. And so I can't place myself outside of a situation and say I'm immune to any of this because it's all playing out inside. So I've got to work at it inside and make sure that I don't become a Rumsfeld or an Ashcroft or a Saddam outside, you know. Or maybe I should say to watch at how I do become a Rumsfeld. On the outside, I mean, you know, we talked about this after the war. You know, we all are a little bit, we all have our own weapons of mass destruction that we use. Sometimes they're called our speech, you know, and we'll use our weapons of mass destruction to destroy other people's lives. Okay, so to watch how we do it in our own lives, try and take control of that. And instead of just blaming outside, look at inside. Look at the terrorist that we have inside of ourselves. You know, look at the part of us that feels so desperate sometimes that we go out and terrorize people in our own little way. You know, we're not going to get arrested for it because, you know, we're nice, upstanding citizens. Are we? But, you know, well, we have our own clever little way with the people that we live with of, you know, being our own terrorist, of flying our own, you know, you fly your own 707, what was it, a 707, you know, that flew into the World Trade Center, you know. For example, how we destroy children's confidence. Yeah, your children's confidence is like their World Trade Center, and how easy it is in this, as an adult, to destroy a child's confidence, you know, putting them down, telling them that they're stupid or worthless. That's like terrorizing them, flying our plane into their World Trade Center and leaving, you know, the child feeling like, what happened? You know, these adults in my life are telling me how terrible I am. What did I do? Okay? So, you know, if we draw analogies and, you know, think like this, it gives us a way to try and, you know, clean up our own lives and it gives us a way to have some kind of patience and compassion for other people who act all this out on the outside in different ways that cause much more global harm than maybe what we do, but we aren't immune to it, you know? Does this help at all?
Well, it does, because I think what you're touching on is the immediacy and the urgency of all of those things when you're in the circumstances that I've described.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the most part they're farther away from us on a daily, every, you know, mm-hmm. the monster in ourselves, the anger, the resentment, the helplessness, the frustration, the overwhelmingness of the world.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in the belly of the beast, it's very present.
Mm-hmm.
Just it's without having tools to prepare to work with that.
Right. Right, and I think this is why it's so important for activists to have a spiritual path.
And that's why I'm also frustrated, yeah, as the university that I was in, it's, you don't even talk about it. In fact, if you do, mm-hmm, you don't finish.
Mm-hmm.
You just, they don't care about
it. Yeah. And I think this is quite important. And actually, the spirituality that can lie behind human rights work, or lie behind social activism, that doesn't have to be limited to people who are Buddhist, because the kind of thing we're talking about has nothing to do with theology, does it? It's universal, it can, you know, no matter what somebody's religion. This is one of my interests in, you know, when I heard, you know, that there's human rights centers here in, you know, in Boise. This is something I think that Buddhism can contribute to the whole discussion on human rights in the world. You might want to take a look at that book that just got donated to the library, The Ethics for a New Millennium, His Holiness's book, because it has a lot to offer to this kind of discussion.
I mean, I know that, yeah, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has excluded great religions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It has a large aspect of human rights built into it,
yeah,
which we have no concept of.
Yeah.
So I think what I need to do is to find the practice and to practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I just want to say that it depends on which part you take. Rumsfeld is known as an extremely intelligent person, as a person who will always tell you honestly and forthright, he won't play any games. So mm-hmm, you take that part of Rumsfeld.
That's true. That's
and
true.
You can also take the part that he's really funny on Saturday Night Live, whatever.
Yeah. No, I think you're right there to say, you know, you could look at Rumsfeld as somebody who's very straight.
He is.
Yeah.
And you could just see him as just smiling more.
Yeah.
And letting that smile widen his views.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yep.
Because we don't know. We really don't know Ashbach. He's very tight.
No. And we don't know what these people are like when they go home to their family.
Well, I think Rumsfeld, you get, yeah, like, at least pretty open.
Yeah.
But with Ashcroft, you think maybe really tight. I'm not sure about
that. Yeah. But, you know, people can be very, very different with in their private life than they are in their public life, too. One last question.
You talked earlier about developing compassionate feelings.
Uh-huh.
Isn't there a fine line without actions, and that's being delusion?
And just cultivating compassionate feelings but without acting. Yet the whole idea of cultivating the feelings is that when you cultivate the feelings, then it gives you a chance to act out of them.
But without actions or delusion?
No.
If I see, again, the example you gave of the homeless person.
Okay.
If I see a homeless person, I think, I feel badly for him. I hope that he attains...
Right.
Shelter.
Right.
But I don't do
anything. Okay.
A week later, I see another homeless person. I say, I feel sorry for him. I hope he attains shelter. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm telling myself that I'm developing compassionate feelings and mm-hmm, I'm a step closer to mm-hmm, becoming a better person, but I still haven't done anything.
Right. But at least you've generated those thoughts, which you didn't generate before. Okay? And by continually generating those thoughts, one day you will do something. Okay. One day you will. Yeah. But if we don't take the time to deliberately generate the thoughts over a long period of time, we'll never do anything. Or if we do something, we'll get discouraged very quickly because the foundation of our compassion isn't strong. Okay? So the thing is to develop those thoughts as much as possible. Do what we're capable of. Also recognize that we can't save the world. You know, we're not going to necessarily be able to make that person have a home, because even if we invited them into our home, they may not want to live there. Some homeless people don't want to live in a home. They want to live you know, out in nature. They want to live, or sometimes they, you know, they don't want to pay a mortgage, or they don't have the skills to work with money to pay a mortgage, or whatever it is. So it's not a thing of giving them what we think they want or what we think they should have. Yeah. Sometimes the way to connect to a homeless person is to look them in the eye and say good morning. And I think that can actually be much more of a gift than avoiding making eye contact but putting some money in their dish.
Some researchers have found that the most devastating aspect of being homeless is that they're invisible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know? And just that process of being recognized as a human being can, you know. Yeah.
I've been homeless. Mm-hmm. I was in Skirking and I was shocked at the perception of me that all of a sudden I had become flawed in some way inside. I did something wrong because I was homeless.
Mm-hmm.
It was just amazing.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah. I think that's quite true, how we take one aspect of somebody's life and impute a whole thing on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's stereotyping.
That's what?
Stereotyping.
Yeah, that's it.
So the fundamental truth, the fundamental basis of all of this is that the practice produces the results.
Mm-hmm.
It's not if or when, it's that it does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is if and when, but it's...
Or if it doesn't, you don't get upset about it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's like when you plant, okay, it's springtime, you know, you're planting stuff in your garden. Do you, if you plant something today, do you dig it up tomorrow to see if the seed is sprouted? No. You let it go there and you know it's going to sprout. Okay, we've got to close because I realize people have other things to do. Let's just sit for a minute and then we'll dedicate.